I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Bond's experiences as director of the White House Situation Room has enabled him to recognize all of the challenges that presidents face during an unanticipated international crisis that frequently happens with a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. He reached some of the few hundred people alive today who understand those difficulties. He turned to written accounts, memoirs from presidents and their advisors, and advisors who were giving different points of advice to the presidents, recollections from National Security Council staff members, and observations from dozens of Situation Room staff members who have served since the facility's 1961 creation. So he has taken a look at 17 international crises in his new book, Presidents in Crisis, Tough Decisions Inside the White House from Truman to Obama. Michael was director of the White House Situation Room under President Ronald Reagan. He is a freelance contributor to a number of publications, the Washington Post Magazine, the Tribune News Service, McClatchy Newspapers, also author of The Nerve Center, Inside the White House Situation Room, and other books. And he has appeared in documentaries on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and he is our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Michael, thank you ever so much for being with us. The book is fascinating. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start, if you don't mind. I believe that many will say, and I believe you say it in the book as well, during a time in the last century when we came very close to a nuclear war, it was a pretty frightening time, and that is the Cuban Missile Crisis. Were we very close to a nuclear war, do you think?
Well, there was great concern, and it depends on whose memoir or story you read about it, how close we came. Some of the Kennedy historians and his acolytes have painted a picture of him backing down the Soviets with a big stick and causing them to back away. But actually, it was a little more practical than that. Kennedy certainly had a big stick, but he and Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, ended up making a bit of a deal. They would take their missiles out of Cuba if we took some of our missiles out of Turkey. And Bobby Kennedy, who arranged this with the Soviet ambassador in Washington, went to great pains to make sure that deal didn't show up for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that the myth of how Kennedy settled the Cuban Missile Crisis kind of lived for a long time before the truth came out.
Yeah. Was it Adlai Stevenson's idea, the exchange of U.S. missiles in Italy and Turkey for the Soviet missiles in Cuba?
He first brought it up, and later he was used as a reason not to do it. Some people that argued against doing it likened it to appeasement and with Hitler and the Brits in 1938. But it was really on Kennedy's mind all along because he had wanted to get him out of Turkey before the crisis even happened. It was just a case of how to manage that along with everything else.
And were the missiles, tell us a little bit more about what preceded this, the disastrous Bay of Pigs. Was that Khrushchev's response to the Bay of Pigs to put missiles in Cuba?
It was certainly all interconnected. The United States discovered that there was no missile or bomber gap. We really weren't behind the Soviets at the time. And that unsettled Khrushchev. And then we had the Bay of Pigs invasion, in which the United States sponsored the exiles, which was a fiasco, but it was every reason for Khrushchev to believe we would try it again. And then there were a number of naval exercises in the Caribbean earlier in 1962 that looked like dress rehearsals for an invasion. And then there was Operation Mongoose, in which the CIA tried to assassinate Castro in Cuba. All these things suggested to Khrushchev that he had to counter that somehow. And he hit upon the idea of installing ballistic missiles in Cuba.
Well, there were. Who was it who alerted the families or the people who were involved with, who were on the in on all of this, telling them that you may have to, we may have bombs, preparing for the worst, and what they were going to do with their families, and who was going to stay in Washington, and who was going to leave. That was pretty dramatic.
It was indeed. In fact, the danger was there. And, of course, in real time, you don't know what we know now. But the good news is that we had a continuity of government program that I was involved with when I was at the White House, and that's trying to get the president and heads of government agencies and out of town in the event of a ballistic missile attack. And it's still ongoing today, and that's one of the reasons why George Bush 43 didn't come back to Washington on 9/11. And so I sort of found out about this through a friend of mine whose father was in Kennedy's advisory group during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he kept a journal. And he was the head of emergency operations, which is now FEMA. And as a result, he was the director of this continuity of government program. And when it got pretty tense, the president told him to make preparations for getting people out of town in the event there was an attack. And he would go around to each cabinet member and the chief justices and all that in the Supreme Court and told them where to meet in a helicopter, and here was their packet, and if they got the call, they were to get out of town.
But the Russians, who knew this at the time and who said so, if anybody, had ruled out nuclear war.
Well, that was the interesting thing, in that Khrushchev didn't want nuclear war any more than Kennedy. And they both sort of painted each other into a corner. And they both sought a way out. And there was never that eyeball-to-eyeball thing that was dramatized in the movies about when we imposed the quarantine. Khrushchev had told the ships to turn around the day before. And so it never really was that dramatic. And as a result, Khrushchev realized that he had to make a move, and Kennedy did as well, and they sort of met in the middle and agreed to find a solution to it. It wasn't that neat in real time, but that's kind of how it worked.
And do you find, when you look at all 17 of these, there have been movies that have portrayed the whole Cuban Missile Crisis, and books as well, some who have written about it, saying that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that the military wanted to take much stronger military action than the president did or many of his advisors. Is that true? Is that true? And is that also true in a lot of these other situations, that the military is really pushing for bold, decisive action?
Well, it runs the gamut from one end to the other of the continuum. For example, the chiefs of staff during the Cuban Missile Crisis were very anxious to strike Cuba, bomb the missiles, invade. And they didn't care if that started World War III. They were ready for it. And it was quite a confrontation on the fourth day of the missile crisis when Curtis LeMay, the Air Force Chief of Staff, all but told Kennedy that he was a weakling if he didn't go to war. But now there's another crisis or two where the shoe was on the other foot, where White House civilians were pushing military action, and the Pentagon generals were kind of reluctant to do something. So it does vary from time to time. And here's the most important thing to take away from those relations, is that the uniformed generals in the Pentagon and the White House civilians rarely understand each other's problems. And it takes some skilled people to bridge those gaps. And some presidents are good at it and some aren't.
You talk in the book about the fog of war, that we may have faulty intelligence, which makes it difficult to make a decision. Was there a fog of war in the Cuban Missile Crisis, or did we have enough and fairly accurate information about what the Soviets were doing?
There was a bit of fog early on because we didn't realize the extent of Soviet troops and weapon systems in Cuba until midway into the crisis. They assembled over 40,000 people, and we didn't realize that. They assembled tactical nuclear weapons down there to put on cruise missiles and on bombers, and we didn't know that. And it wasn't until the U-2 overflight started discovering these things, that we sent in lower-level reconnaissance aircraft to get better images. And then we realized the extent of the weaponry and personnel that were there in Cuba and realized how significant it was. And Kennedy had drawn a red line. We can come back to that with Obama and Syria. And he later regretted it. He said, if they introduce offensive missiles into Cuba, we're not going to stand for it. And he later told Bobby that that sort of boxed him in, took away some of his options.
And you may as well mention, we will get to Obama, but Obama got boxed in with a comment about Syria, right?
Absolutely. And there's a couple things in common. Both were said just before a U.S. election. Kennedy, before the midterms in 62, and the Republicans were giving him a lot of trouble for being weak on communism. And then Obama said, I drew a red line on Syrian chemical weapons in August of 2012, right before his reelection. And his aide said later it was an ad lib, and he wished he hadn't done it.
We're going to take a couple phone calls related to this particular crisis, and we'll move on to more, but feel free to come back to this one. Our next one will be, and it's a very detailed account of what happened with President George W. Bush on 9/11, where Dick Cheney was. It's a moment-by-moment analysis of how that international crisis was dealt with and how certain people became prominent in their call for action in Iraq. How did we get from 9/11 to Iraq? We'll talk about that in a moment as we continue with our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And Phil in Hebron, Illinois is our first caller for you. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon. I have a quick question for you. I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis and dove under my desk and all that. I've read a couple books, written very authoritative books with a lot of footnotes. I even contacted one of the authors after I read it. I believe one of them was called Red Star Rising. And the man had done a lot of research into what the Soviet Navy was doing while Kennedy crossed the embargo line. And he maintained in the book, had footnotes, and I contacted about him, that the Soviet Navy was carrying nuclear-tipped torpedoes, so another nuclear weapon. They were within the demarcation line and running in with the task force. I want to know if your fellow knows anything about that.
Well, indeed. I was a career naval officer, and I lived through the Cold War, and my specialty was Soviet submarines.
Oh, and I guess you would know about it.
They routinely carried nuclear torpedoes, one or two, the submarines. But they were under strict orders not to use them. Khrushchev ordered a ban on any nuclear weapons use and was very sensitive to it and had an iron hand on it. But, of course, the U.S. Navy wanted to send their message to these submarines with practice depth charges, which was sort of a provocative act, and Kennedy put a stop to that because he thought they might react to that the wrong way. So, yeah, they were there, but it wasn't quite as unstable as it may have seemed.
Thanks so much for your call, and Eugene and Viola, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guests. In 1963, I was going to County Normal, going to school at Brokaw. And in October, and when they started moving troops southeast toward Florida, everybody was just plain scared. That's all I got.
Yeah, the American population was plain scared. He's right, Michael.
Indeed. In fact, some of the newsmen got wind of mobilization of troops because they were asked to embed with them and go with them and report on what was going to be a big invasion of Cuba. And Kennedy just said, sit tight. We're going to try this blockade first before we get to invasions. And I'm glad that he was a little more cautious than the military.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. The author of Presidents in Crisis, Michael Bone, is our guest this hour. Michael Bone is Tough Decisions Inside the White House from Truman to Obama is the full title of the book. Michael was director of the White House Situation Room under President Ronald Reagan. As you heard him say, he was career Navy officer. He is a contributor to the Washington Post magazine, McClatchy Newspapers, the Tribune News Services, also author of Nerve Center, Inside the White House Situation Room, and many other books. There are 17 different moments of international crisis, and presidents all the way from Truman through Obama are talked about and written about. He's gathered information from all kinds of people, so you've got contrary stories, and he finds, as near as we can find, what the truth is about all this by talking to all kinds of people. So it's a fascinating book. We'll move on to September 11th and how President Bush responded to the news when the first plane hit the World Trade Center, then when the second plane hit, and his movement through the sky, really. He was in Air Force One, traveling around by jet for a good portion of the day. What the response was in Washington, and how we got to the point of taking on the people who did this to us to invading Iraq. We'll talk about that next. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. Michael Bond is our guest. Presidents in Crisis, the subject of this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's move on to September 11, and we were reminded, you certainly give us a minute-by-minute account of that extraordinary day, how nobody knew what was happening. It was a horrendously awful day, wasn't it, Michael?
Indeed, and I had the chance to interview a lot of people that were involved, starting with the director of the Situation Room at the time, who was traveling with President Bush, and so he told me everything that happened in Florida, in Air Force One, and until they came back to Washington that evening. And then I interviewed the duty officers that were in the sit room that day. It's not just a conference room. It's the President's Intelligence Center, his alert center. And although they evacuated the White House as soon as before the plane hit the Pentagon, the Situation Room staff elected to stay. And they faxed the names of the people that stayed behind the CIA, and they called the list the dead list.
Mm.
The fourth plane was still in the air, and it was either going to come in and hit the Capitol or the White House.
Mm.
So those people had some real white-knuckle stories, and I was able to sort of piece together the story of a series of events. But it started, as you know, with the first impact in New York. And that's when Captain Lohr, she was also a Navy officer, went to see Andy Card in the school in Florida and said there's been a plane hit the World Trade Center. And they relayed that on to the president because they thought it was an accident. And then by that time, they were in a holding room, Captain Lohr, waiting for the president to finish talking to the grade schoolers. And they saw the second plane hit the second tower. And that's when Card went in and whispered in the president's ear, we're at war. And they decided immediately after he made some remarks to get out of town and get into Air Force One and slip back into that continuity of government program that I told you about, which is getting the president aloft, away, and out of danger. And that's what started a series of plane flights and movements through the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. And nobody knew the extent of this. There were rumors, tell me where these came from, that there was a plane after Air Force One as well, right?
Yes, that arose because of some misstatement somewhere along the line. And it was attributed to a duty officer in the sit room, and they all told me that they weren't behind it. And it was the reference to the code word Angel, which was the Secret Service word for Air Force One. And all that spread like wildfire throughout the government that day. And another reason why Bush stayed on Air Force One and just took off and flew to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana to try to seek safety. And there was never a threat to Air Force One, but there were all kinds of false alarms. The duty officers who were there told me about one, that there was a rumor that the old executive office building across the road from the West Wing was on fire, and one of the duty officers stood up and with a phone in his hand and look out the window. The sit room is not buried in the basement. There's windows there. And said, no, I don't see any smoke. But it was rampant. And those things were going on left and right.
Well, talk about a fog of war. It seems to me as though you would have the ultimate fog of war on that day. Where was intelligence coming from? Where were we able to gather what might be next?
We didn't have a clue.
We didn't have
a clue. And the only thing that feasibly could be done was to ground all the aircraft, prohibit all the ones that were on the ground from taking off, and all the thousands of planes that were in the airspace above the United States to land immediately. And the story had it was that the Secretary of Transportation decided to do that from the White House bomb shelter. But actually, it was a group of people in Herndon, Virginia, about 30 miles outside of Washington, and they all looked at each other. This is the FAA command center. Looked at each other and said, "We got to get the planes down." And they decided on their own. And it was a good thing they did. That's when we started to piece things together and realized there had been four hijackings, and there were no others. And that started to bring comfort to people that there were no others about to happen.
I remember that day. Nobody had a clue what was next. You were just sitting in front of the TV thinking, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen next?
And I was here across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. I live just half a block from the river. And I remember seeing the plane that was en route to the Pentagon fly over my neighborhood.
Oh, my goodness.
And I knew it was too big, and it was not in the normal flight path to Reagan National, which is just up the river. And so when I interviewed those folks in the White House, it was really scary because they, all the ones that were off that day, got on their bikes or on their cars and fought their way into the White House to help out. Hmm. And all the people in the White House and everybody in Washington, D.C. was fighting to go the other way. And it was just a mob, a mad, terrible scene.
Mm. Where was the vice president?
Well, that's an interesting story. He was in his office in the West Wing, and when the plane looked like it was headed for the Pentagon, the FAA called the White House, and the Secret Service went up and grabbed him, just physically pushed and pummeled him down the stairs through a secret tunnel into an old 1930s, 40s bomb shelter in the East Wing basement. It's called the President's Emergency Operations Center, the PEOC, and he stayed down there the rest of the day along with several senior White House staff folks, Condoleezza Rice and a couple other folks. And the White House sit room people had to connect the vice president who was in the bomb shelter to the president who was in Air Force One. And that's why they didn't evacuate, because they knew they were crucial to connecting everybody through telephones and secure telephones and faxes and all that.
And how did the president handle all of that? This? Imagine all this happening and you're flying around in Air Force One a good chunk of the day. When did he want? I know he wanted to go back to Washington. When did he want to go back? Should he have gone back earlier? Why didn't he? Did it make sense to go back at, 6 o'clock or whenever he did go back?
Well, it's easy for us to criticize now, but it was a terribly fluid dynamic. And our plans, our contingency plans, always had the president away from Washington. So he kind of did what several presidents before him had always anticipated doing. So in that regard, he did the right thing. It just set a kind of a bad message to a really scared populace.
Right.
And he left Louisiana and went to Omaha, Nebraska, which is the headquarters of Strategic Command and a big node in the continuity of government system. And he had a closed-circuit video teleconference with everybody, connecting him to the vice president in the basement and everyone else. And that's when they decided he'd better come home. So it was a scary thing, and the nation was probably better served if by him staying in that covert, that black system that he went into.
Mm-hmm.
And as you recall, the vice president continued in an undisclosed location for weeks. And that was, he was in a local bomb shelter in Washington, D.C., which I can't tell you where it's located, but that was the undisclosed location. And he was working from the continuity of government system.
Interesting. I'll have to ask you, we have a number of phone calls, so let's take some of those right now, and they'll take us into other international crisis moments, but how we got from, we're going to get the people who did this to us, the president forcefully making that statement at the rubble of the World Trade Center, to the invasion of Iraq. We'll talk about that as we continue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And here on the Ideas Network, you're listening to Michael Bond. Michael is the author of Presidents in Crisis, Tough Decisions Inside the White House from Truman to Obama. And he speaks as a historian of this, but also as a person who was inside the White House, director of the White House Situation Room under President Ronald Reagan. Let's go to phone calls, and let's go to Daryl in Couderay first. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, sir, how would you explain the unconnected call or phone calls that Solicitor General of the United States Ted Olson stated he received from his wife, Barbara Olson, who was on Flight 77, the flight that impacted the Pentagon on September 11th, which the FBI stated under oath in court at the Zacharias Moussaoui trial were unconnected calls? How can an unconnected call be connected in any way?
You know, I don't know too much about that subject. I limited my investigation and my analysis to presidential decision making, and I really can't comment. I don't know.
Let's go next to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah. Good afternoon. So I'd like to kind of fast forward to today.
All right.
What would the situation be if, with all of these negotiations that are going on with the Iranians, the Israelis perceive that it's going the wrong way, that they feel that they're up against the wall, and decide to take unilateral action on their own, and perhaps use a small tactical nuke to take out the Iranian facilities? What is the reaction of the president going to be in a scenario like that, which is, frankly, very possible?
Again, I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I will tell you that if the Israelis were to strike unilaterally at the Iranians, one, they would merely set back that program temporarily, and they wouldn't eliminate it. Two, it would cause a huge calamity throughout the Middle East and the United States and Europe. And the president doesn't want to see that happen, and no president would want to see that happen. I used to think that Obama and Netanyahu were playing a good cop, bad cop routine with the Iranians. I don't think they are, because Obama's seeking a negotiated settlement, and I think Netanyahu would like to have a military strike. But it would so inflame the world that I wouldn't want to be in the sit room when that happened. That's pretty dangerous stuff. But the most important thing that I take away from that possibility are the experts that I've heard saying that that's not going to solve anything. It's not going to. You cannot bomb the knowledge of how to make a nuclear weapon out of somebody's head. So I just hope it doesn't happen. I don't have a very good answer for you, sir.
Thanks for the call. Chuck on Facebook writes, these kinds of situations are often examined to see if groupthink is occurring. I'd like to hear the guest's thoughts on this. To what extent is it a risk and how it is prevented?
Well, he needs to go to the head of the class. He gets a gold star for today. Because groupthink is a constant problem in presidential crisis management. And it cropped up for the first time in what is now a well-documented case study with Harry Truman and his theater commander in the Korean War, Douglas MacArthur, was very aggressive, and he got ahead of where he was going and launched a huge offensive and caused a what we call mission creep. Instead of repulsing the North Koreans, he invaded North Korea and threatened China. It's a classic case of Truman and his advisors being in complete agreement. It was called galloping consensus and groupthink. It's where there are no dissenting voices. And it can be a problem, and it has plagued presidents ever since, because it can arise in an attempt to inhibit leaks by limiting the number of people advising the president. And as a result, experts and naysayers and devil's advocates get left out. And it showed up in Jimmy Carter's administration. It showed up in several others. It's a very dangerous two-edged sword. You want to limit the people involved to keep a secret, but then that just sometimes you end up with a whole bunch of sycophants who say, yes, boss, that's what we ought to do.
Tell me about the statement and the interaction that President Truman had with, a New York Daily News reporter when he was asked if he might use an atomic weapon in North Korea. What was the truth about that situation? Did he think about that, using it?
Well, he misspoke terribly.
Hmm.
Of course, at that time, and still today, the president controls the use of any nuclear weapon. And the orders come out of that football that the military carries around, the briefcase. But Truman was impatient with news reporters in press conferences. He'd get a little short with them. He'd get irritated with their questions, and he had a tendency, as his Secretary of State said, for his mouth to get ahead of his brain. And he would say dumb things from time to time. And so he was being pestered about... This was after the Chinese counterattack, and we were in deep trouble. It was a pretty dark hour. This is December 1950. And someone said, well, were you going to use the atomic bomb? And he said, no, we don't want to do that. But that decision is in the hands of Douglas MacArthur, which was completely erroneous. It wasn't, but he said it. And everybody in that news conference jumped up and ran out to file a story,
right,
especially the newswire people. You know, Truman considering the use of atomic bomb in Korea. Of course, he had used it in Japan 5 years earlier. So it was big news. It was all because he lost his composure and misspoke. And there was never any intention to use it.
Hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We go to Rich in Rhinelander next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. I want to honor any president in crisis in terms of decision-making as much as the next American, and yet still there's a kind of disconnect in my memory in our recent history in that after 9/11, my students were going off to war. I taught in a college setting, and we had a president who told us to go out and shop and then landed on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier saying, mission accomplished, when quite obviously that wasn't the case. And there were all these postings of alerts, yellow and orange and so on and so forth, during an extended period of time. I need the advice of your author in terms of how in the world does this kind of counteraction to actually mobilizing the population and saying, we are at war, all of us are at war, you are going to have to sacrifice for us to succeed, square with the idea of a president in crisis. I don't want to respect people who manipulate public opinion.
Mm. Well, sadly, over the 65 years of crises that I looked at, presidents always seem to try to manipulate public opinion, most of the time to galvanize support for their preferred solution to the crisis. I personally join a number of people who criticize President Bush, George W. Bush, for his immediate pivot to Iraq. I know we wanted to get to that shortly.
Yes.
But, and I'll come back to that. But no, he did not. The whole thing about go shopping was poorly chosen. I think what he was trying to do was show this is going to be a long, drawn-out affair. And I think he erroneously called it the global war on terror. Terror is not an enemy. It's a tactic. And a lot of the politicians during that time misused all that threat, I think, to their advantage. I'm quite a cynic when it comes to presidents and the public, as you might imagine. So I tend to agree in many respects with what the man just said.
Well, let's talk at this moment, before we go back to phone calls, of how we got from we're going to get the people who did this to us to an invasion of Iraq. Who was President Bush listening to? Why did we go that direction?
Well, he was surrounded by what the pundits have called neoconservatives at the time, neocons. And the foremost of that group was Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz. And an hour after the plane hit the Pentagon, 2 hours after the plane hit the Pentagon, Secretary Rumsfeld and his deputy Wolfowitz got together with several other people in the Pentagon, and they said, how can we sweep Iraq into this? This is 2 hours after the plane.
2 hours after.
Oh, 2 hours. And they had that as an agenda item, according to Paul O'Neill, who was Bush's first Treasury Secretary. He wrote later that from the beginning of the administration, they were trying to figure out how to get Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And there was a lot of false information, a fog of war, faulty intelligence, and faulty interpretation of intelligence that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And he wasn't, never was. And, in fact, that showed up the next day in the sitroom. And I'll read you a little something here. This is President Bush walking through the Situation Room conference room, talking to Dick Clark, who was the White House head of counterterrorism activity, was sort of in charge of our initial reaction on 9/11. And he said, I know you have a lot to do, this is to Dick Clark, but I want you as soon as you can to go back over everything and see if Saddam did this. But Mr. President, Clark said, Al-Qaeda did this. I know, but see if Saddam was involved. And when Clark gave Bush a few more buts, the president grew a little testy and said, look into Iraq, Saddam, and walked out. So within weeks, with all those crisis meetings at Camp David and in the sit room, and Iraq kept coming up and coming up. And it was clear from the beginning that they wanted to pivot to Iraq. And the man that took Clark's place, Rand Beards, quit in frustration. And he said, they still don't get it. Instead of going all out against Al-Qaeda and eliminating our vulnerabilities at home, they want to invade Iraq again. And it was a terrible mistake. Many people believe the biggest foreign policy blunder in United States history.
Hmm. Do you think so?
I think so. I do. And because the real issue in the beginning was Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And we under-resourced that thing and ultimately snatched victory from the jaws of defeat, or actually it's the other way around, defeat from the jaws of victory, and shifted to Iraq and just created a huge problem. I wouldn't have wanted to have been the president in those circumstances, but most of the people whose opinions I respect believe it was a mistake to leave the Taliban Al-Qaeda campaign to go to Iraq.
Rich, thank you very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. We're talking about presidents in crisis this hour of the show with Michael Bond. That's the title of his book, subtitled Tough Decisions Inside the White House from Truman to Obama, because we only had an hour, which seems like a long time, but these stories are worth hearing in some detail. He covers 17 instances of crisis, starting with the Korean War and Harry Truman, Ike, the Suez War, and the U-2 shootdown, John Kennedy, Cuban Missile Crisis, LBJ, we'll get to him in a moment. We have a caller who wants to talk about LBJ, Richard Nixon, the October War, 1973, Watergate in the Mideast, Gerald Ford, the Maiguez seizure, a bold action, Jimmy Carter, the Iranian hostage taking, Ronald Reagan, Beirut barracks bombing, and George Herbert Walker Bush, the Persian Gulf War, Bill Clinton, the East Africa embassy bombings, George W. Bush, we just talked about, and Barack Obama, the Arab Spring. So we're welcoming phone calls for him. And he has an interesting background as well. He's a career naval officer, and he was director of the White House Situation Room under President Ronald Reagan. He's the author of Nerve Center, Inside the White House Situation Room, and other books, and is our guest this hour. More from you And you can call us at 800-486-8655. You can send a message at talk@wpr.org. You can write to us on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. So all of those means of communication available to you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. John is next in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, John.
Hello, are you there?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. Ms. Dunn, I love your show. I've been listening to it for years. I really appreciate the things you put out for us. And I'm not sure if this is one of the 17 crises that was mentioned in your author's book, but I've always been kind of curious about the background of the Potonkin Gulf incident and Lyndon Johnson's use of it as justification to expand America's involvement in Vietnam. This kind of goes to the idea both of manipulation of the public, but also maybe of groupthink and self-manipulation, self-deception. To what extent did the Johnson White House and Pentagon know that Tonkin Gulf did not happen the way that the American people were initially told that it happened, and to what extent were they confused, or they were kind of going to worst case scenario, and then used it to make another one of the greatest blunders in American foreign policy?
Well, I will say up front that I did not study the Gulf of Tonkin, but I have run into it from time to time, and I know there's a great body of work on either side of the argument that it was overblown and over-exaggerated and used to further foreign policy goals that people have objected to over the years. And there was I will say that the Vietnam War was a dark spot in our political military history. And Johnson, during the 1967 war and the 1968 seizure of the USS Pueblo, was handicapped in his dealing with those crises because of the souring of the mood in the United States over the Vietnam War. I will tell you one anecdote, and I apologize that I don't know more about the allegations of that you're talking about, and I'm well aware that there are some about the fact that it was overblown. I interviewed a guy who was on duty that day in the White House Situation Room, and they didn't have very good maps. Or in this case, a chart, because it was in the water. And the president came down and said, "Where did this happen?" And the guy put his finger down on the chart and said, "Right here." But his finger was 15 miles wide, based on the scale of the map.
Wow.
And so there, from the beginning, there was some ambiguity about whether they were in international waters or in territorial waters. But I apologize for not knowing more about that, and as a naval officer, I should. But I know it was a thorny issue, and it's been the source of a lot of debate ever since.
Hmm. Interesting
thank
question.
You very much.
Yeah, thank you, John, very much for your call. Tell me just a little bit more about the Situation Room. How does somebody become director of the Situation Room, Michael?
Well, now they have a process for it, but for years it was a CIA person that was sent down there temporarily, and I was recruited. I was on active duty by John Poindexter and a man that I had served with in the Navy who'd gone over to work for Poindexter. And they knew that I had run operational intelligence centers, and they wanted somebody they could trust. And so I was just requested to come over and do it. Now they have a rotating means of interviewing people from each service, from each intelligence agency, from the State Department. And it generally rotates amongst the agencies for a two-year tour, and you're asked to turn in an application, if you will, or asked to interview, and then they go through and select whoever they want to do it. But I'd sort of gone over on cronyism, if you will, because the people that I had worked for in the Navy were over there, and they knew that I could do the job. And then I sort of got wrapped up in the Iran-Contra affair also. It happened at that time.
Oh,
it was quite an exciting period at the White House.
I would imagine. And how often, when is the Situation Room used? We have this idea about it that it's, you know, when something absolutely incredible is taking place and it's state-of-the-art and it's top, top, top secret. Is it used often or just on very rare occasions, like the 17?
Well, first of all, it's 24/7 operation.
It is.
Staff rotate, the duty officers. They are the president's connection to the world, and they manage the a river of information that flows into the presidency. And they look out for things that he might be interested in, and they look out for potential crises. The conference room, there are three conference rooms today. The one you saw during the bin Laden raid was one of the smaller ones. But there are three. I had two when I was there. And that's used every day for a meeting of some kind. Not crisis meetings, but just the staff meeting. We used to have the NSC staff meeting in the sit room conference room. But when something happens, it takes on a little different face. And there is a public perception associated with the sit room. And the presidents and his advisors use the public perception of the sit room to their advantage. If they want to send a message that this president is serious about a crisis, they have him meet in the sit room. If they want the president to appear business as usual, this is not a big deal, they have him meet in the Oval Office. And so you can send a message just by where the president meets.
Interesting.
When something happens.
And when you would see something that you thought could be particularly dangerous or very noteworthy, is there a direct call to the president, even if he or she is asleep at 3 in the morning, or does it go through the chief of staff?
It varies with the president. There were only two people that could call President Reagan, but I came close one day.
Really?
If I have 30 seconds.
Yeah, sure you do.
I was watching the space shuttle take off, a Challenger, 1986.
Oh.
I saw it blow up.
Oh.
I was watching on CNN, and I knew I had to go tell somebody. So I went upstairs to John Poindexter's office. He was the National Security Advisor, and I opened the door without knocking and without an appointment, which is you just don't do in the West Wing. And I said, this shuttle's exploded. And he looked at me, and I said, ugh, and go tell George, which is the vice president, George Bush. So I went next door, did the same thing, just threw the door open. The secretaries were grabbing my sleeve.
Oh.
And I said the same thing. The shuttle's exploded. And he said, oh, no, go tell Don. This is Don Regan, the chief of staff. I did the same thing with people just trying to stop me, and I just said, this is important. I opened the door, and the shuttle's exploded. His eyes got real big. And he said, let's go tell the president. And I knew by that time I needed to get in the back of the line. I wasn't going to go open with the Secret Service.
Right.
The Oval Office. They would have just shot me.
Oh,
even
no.
Even though they all knew who I was. So I let Don Regan open the door. And we all went in there, and I tuned up CNN, and they had a loop showing the explosion. And we, and they said, go get a hold of the head of NASA and help him work through this, because he's going to have a problem on his hands. So I invited the head of NASA over and sat him down in my office and said, here, let's work this problem together. Because he had no experience in crisis management. And it was a terrible day. But sometimes that happens.
There are terrible days. That's true. One more phone call. We only have about a minute left, everybody. I'm sorry. Anne in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I was interested in the fact that Jimmy Carter was routinely referred to as, you know, kind of a peanut farmer from nowhere and, you know, an outsider and everything. I think he actually graduated from the Naval Academy and that his specialty was nuclear engineering or maybe nuclear physics. I think he was the only president we ever had who was technically trained, and I wondered what the attitude, maybe, you know, part of the attitude of disdain toward him might have been the fact that he probably knew as much about things like security and, you know, technical matters as the people who were advising him.
I need to hold you there, Anne. We have about 30 seconds in response, Michael.
Well, he was indeed a nuclear submariner, and he had a sailor's tongue that showed up during the crises. But he was unfairly characterized during the Iran hostage as being too timid, but he had no leverage. He had no other options except to be patient. And when they tried to rescue them, it was completely out of character. And I believe that's because Ted Kennedy was starting to win some primaries during the 1980 election cycle.
Mm.
So it was a complicated case, and I think he was unfairly painted with the wrong brush.
I wish we had more hours so we can get to all 17, but the book is fascinating. Michael, thank you. It was just a great pleasure to talk to you this hour. Thank you.
It was fun talking to you, Kathleen.
Michael Bond, the book is Presidents in Crisis, Tough Decisions Inside the White House from Truman to Obama. Michael's written another book as well, and he was director of the White House Situation Room under President Ronald Reagan. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this show, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production. And we'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political. We'll talk about bilingual education is a good thing next week as well.